is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
As pressure mounts on a local council to use their port to help drought-stricken King Island farmers, the council washes its hands of the situation. You'll hear that news shortly on the Country Hour. Plus, the first importation of llamas from North America to Australia in around three decades. It's an extraordinary story, and you're going to hear those details today too. If you're in the mood to buy a dairy farm, what was formerly Australia's largest dairy farm has put up the for sale sign too. More details on that coming up today on the Country Hour. And you can be involved too. Send us a text 0467 842 722, or you can indeed give us a call 1300 977 222. A lot to talk about to get together today on the Country. You might want to tell us how you feel about the Colac Otway Shire and their use of the Apollo Bay port, whether it's in the interests of their tourism business, which is obviously a very important tourism part of Australia, or if they should be doing more to help drought-stricken farmers. You can tell us 0467 842 722. We'll get into the details of that story next.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Pressure is mounting on a local council to use the port in their shire to help drought-stricken farmers on King Island. But so far, they've steadfastly refused. I've just got a new statement from them. I will read that to you shortly. But here's a little of Ian Sauer from Tas Farmers yesterday, pointing the finger squarely at the Colac Otway Shire for not helping farmers in their time of need.
Rubbish and crocodile tears. This is not a normal business day. These are desperate times. The farmers on King Island are really facing a tough time, and we need to be all working together to make this work. And I find it quite extraordinary that we've got everyone, we've got the Premier, we've got the Ag Minister, we've got NRE, we've got Need for Feed, we've got truck drivers, we've got farmers, we've got the Bass Strait chipping in. Everyone is doing it for nothing or at cost. The only hold-up is the Port of Otway. And now they should have said last week, yes, we will do it. We understand what the farmers are going through. We will do it.
So what's at stake here? 500 tonnes of fodder is sitting in Swan Hill waiting for the OK to be freighted out of Apollo Bay in Victoria to get to desperate King Island farmers. It's already been given the tick of approval by Tasmania's biosecurity officers, but organisers are waiting for a decision from the Colac Otway Shire Council. The feed has been coordinated by the Lions Club of Australia's national project, Need for Feed. Chairman Graeme Cockerell is imploring the council to be good neighbours, adding an alternative then that port could add another $70,000 to the cost of sending the feed to the island.
We have negotiated to buy 500 tonnes of new season oat and hay from near Swan Hill.
And this is for the King Island farmers?
King Island farmers. We're also sending 200 tonnes of cattle pallets.
Okay, that's a significant amount.
Yeah, and we've got, last count, I think 87 requests for assistance off the island. And that involves probably about, last count, maybe about 4,500 head of stock, mostly which are beef cattle. I think probably three quarters of those numbers would be beef cattle, and there's some dairy, obviously, being King Island, and some sheep.
And how much do they need it, and sort of how quickly do they need it?
They need it yesterday, and we've actually been buying hay from Tasmania. Well, there's an advantage in that you don't need to clear biosecurity from Tasmania, the main part of Tasmania, to King Island. But there's Tasmania itself is dry, probably not as dry as King Island, but nearly impossible to buy hay there. We've bought a few small amounts through a load here and a load there, half a load, probably no more than 400 bales we've been able to buy in Tasmania itself.
But it's pretty much dried up, so that's why you've been collecting in Victoria.
Yeah, well, to take it to Tasmania, anywhere in Tasmania, it has to pass biosecurity. We've got weeds over here that they don't have, and probably some bugs that they don't have. But we've gone through that process. We had pre-approval, then we've had a sample of the hay weed seed tested at a lab in Melbourne. We've got a certificate for that, which has been approved by the Tasmanian government, NRE, this morning.
And that would have been pretty onerous.
Yeah, it's something that we haven't had to do before. We've been running this project for, 18th year. We've had to jump through, every now and then you get hoops to jump through and you find a way around them. So
now it's in Swan Hill, but you've got another hold-up.
Yeah, the closest port is Apollo Bay, which is about 150 km or 5.5-6 hours in a truck, versus it's been suggested that we use Port Welshpool, which is suitable for the boats to take the hay, but it's 150 km further by road. It is also more than 150 km further by sea. That is a significant cost to our charity.
How much cost would that add, going to Welshpool instead of Apollo Bay?
Our drivers, while they're volunteers, it's mostly the same guys fronting up again each time, and they get we make sure that they get their fuel back and also their running costs on their truck. And the difference it's about the 500 tons is about 35 truckloads. The trucks will run out of weight capacity before they run out of bales, if that makes sense. So
yep,
you can only put so much on the trucks, about 35 truckloads. The extra cost to us by road, I've worked out to about be just over $18,000, and by sea is about $50,000.
So almost 70 grand.
Yeah, 70 grand, bit over between the difference between the two ports.
So where are you at with the port of Otway?
I've had a conversation with the Colac Otway Mayor about a week and a half ago. She was good enough to ring me back at the end of the day, and I sent her an email first thing Monday last week, and so far we've heard back that they've received the email, and that's all.
So as far as you're concerned, they haven't decided either way. In the meantime, the farmers are waiting.
That's exactly right, yeah.
There's all sorts of rumours around that perhaps the Victorian government or the Tasmanian government might subsidise going to Welshpool, Port Welshpool, but you just want to get it there.
Yeah, the Tassie government's been really good to us in the past. We've bought quite a lot of hay over, and we're hoping that they can dip into their coffers to help. Going back to the last big drought over here, They shouted us some loads. We bought quite a few loads over from Tasmania for the last big drought over here. 4 years ago, the King Island farmers through their Lions Club over there donated at 700 bales of hay and silage, which we did bring over to Port Welshpool. That was going to East Gippsland and to the Bega Valley in New South Wales. So, you know, Welshpool made sense anyway for that one. This is a way of paying them back, I guess.
What do you say to the local council at Apollo Bay?
There was a fair bit of publicity about, I think it was Bass Strait Freight tried to bring cattle into Apollo Bay, which was knocked back by the Shire there. We were aware of that. However, we think this is totally different. Tasmanian people and their government has been really good to us and over here. We've had our fair share of droughts and fires and, you know, floods in New South Wales and even right through into Queensland that they've been able to help us out with. And I think that it's time to be a good neighbour.
That is Graham Cockerell there from Need for Feed, which is the Lions Club's national project for delivering much needed fodder and feed for animals in times of need. Has been going for a very long time. It's probably helped many of you in areas of Victoria as well, as described there. We did get a statement this morning from the Colac Otway Shire Council. We were meant to be able to speak to someone today. That hasn't happened. I think the next statement is probably why. But I'll read some of it to you now. Listen to it. Take an almighty turn in the middle. And I quote, Council supports finding a solution to aid to King Island. Council Colac Otway Shire Council is supporting a bid to find transport options to deliver much-needed food for livestock to the farmers of King Island. CEO Anne Howard said it was wonderful that Need for Feed Australia has been able to source 500 tonnes or about 770 bales of current season oat and hay near Swan Hill. Quoting, a range of parties are working to find the most suitable arrangement for the transport of this essential feed to King Island, Ms Howard said. Ms Howard confirmed the council received a request to ship the freight via the port of Apollo Bay. However, the scale of the proposed operations cannot be supported at this time. The port of Apollo Bay is a local port and not a commercial trading port. Council has received an independent engineering report that has assessed that freight movements of this scale present risks to the port's infrastructure and operations. Colac Otway Shire Council, as the port manager, and the Victorian Department of Transport and Planning, as the port owner, have determined that until those risks are resolved, it's not appropriate to approve the movement of this freight at this time, especially while viable options are available. Hay and feed can be readily shipped from commercial ports across Victoria, including Portland, Geelong and Welshpool. There are a number of vessels currently operating from these ports to King Island that could accommodate this request. Council understands that these alternative ports may come at a greater cost. However, these ports are already well equipped and experienced in the safe and effective movement of this freight with the urgency required. End quote. Goes on to say again that it's happy for aid to go to King Island, just refusing to do so out of its port. Interesting that the information about it not being possible due to engineering concerns wasn't available from council yesterday when we asked, but available today. We will request another interview with Colac Otway Shire Council to get more details from them. But that is their answer to Need for Feed and to farmers in Tasmania asking for feed to get to desperate farmers in King Island that are suffering their worst drought in 100 years. Right now, you can tell me what you think. Send a text 0467 842 722 or you can give us a call. 1300 977 222 is the number. Someone from Colac Otway Shire Council would like to call that number. It is again 1300 977 222.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour.
Let's talk about something completely different right now. The first importation of live llamas from North America in nearly three decades has brought some much-needed new genetics into Australia's herd. There are only around 1,200 llamas in Australia, and one breeder has been on a personal mission for nearly 2 years to add to that. Jane Ackland is from Wombane in the ACT and has just received the animals from the quarantine facility outside of Melbourne and says it's been a long journey to get them here.
Importing llamas was really a project of the heart for me. It took 2 years to go from an idea that seemed highly unlikely to actually having these five beautiful llamas arrive in February this year. I'm actually a relative newcomer to the Australian llama community, having only just bought my first llamas around 5 years ago. They grew from being companion animals to me and to my family to having therapeutic value for us as my young nephew Mitch fought his battle with cancer. Mitch and his sister Jess helped train and care for the llamas, and Mitch would find comfort in the photos and videos of the llamas when he was receiving treatment in Sydney. Tragically, he lost his battle with cancer at age 16. And I then was not long after diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, along with rheumatoid arthritis, and left the workforce ahead of schedule. And the llamas and their curious, gentle, social nature were bringing me peace and new purpose. And what I decided I wanted to do as my next project was to continue to improve the quality of the Australian llamas that I've got in my herd from the perspectives of conformation, height, athleticism, beauty, fleece, and their temperament. And it had been a really long time since Australia acquired new genetics. I believe the last import that we had from the United States was from Mick and Anita Westcombe's import in the mid-1990s, and that was the last major import to come in.
So around three decades. there hadn't been new llamas into Australia. And as you've just outlined, this is something deeply personal for you. So what was the journey like to find the llamas that you wanted to bring into the country and also get them here?
There actually were llamas imported, I think, from New Zealand after that US import in the mid-90s. And I did look at New Zealand, but I decided that the type of llama that I was looking at was the type that was found in North America. Most of the llamas we have here in Australia came from South American origins, of course, and North American development. But I really liked the style of the very tall, athletic llamas that I could see in some of the long-standing breeders over in the US, up around Montana and Oregon and California. And so I started the search by going across every single website that there was on llamas in the United States. I read all of the articles that were online. I joined the International Llama Registry and did the research on genetics through to really long-standing ancestry details. And I was watching live streaming American llama shows and auctions to try and get a sense of the market over there and what the animals looked and moved like and what their produce was like. I was really fortunate to have some amazing llama breeders really generously share their time, experience and advice with me on this search. And they helped me refine my thinking and search to identify the animals that would have the genetic diversity and the phenotype and with the demonstrated quality and consistency deep in their lines that I was looking for.
So you got the help. Then you had to bring the llamas here. So you buy llamas in America. What's their journey like? Do you fly them? Do you ship them to Australia?
Yes. And look, just to show how this is a question of passion for me, I actually bought them before I had approval to bring them in. And fortunately, I had some really wonderful breeders who were very understanding and patient with me, because my first inquiry to buy a llama was taking place in November 2022, and they didn't actually fly out until January 2024. So it was a really long time, and I first reached out to the USDA, or the United States Department of Agriculture, as well as the Australian Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry in April 2023. And had really great support and great help from both of those organisations in finding our way through. The two countries needed to redesign their import conditions and agreements because it had been such a long time. Previous import conditions were no longer being practised over in America, particularly with respect to blue tongue virus, and so they needed to change that. I had an exporter who was very helpful in connecting all of the dots over there in America, and they spent 1 month in quarantine in Chicago. So they got a 30-something hour road trip from Oregon over to Chicago, where America was having a huge cold front with ice and snowstorms. And these llamas needed to be shorn completely to the skin for the trip as part of the import conditions. So we put that off till the last possible minute, and then rapidly bought some emergency rugs to keep them warm until they arrived here in the Australian summer. And yes, they flew. So they flew by Qantas, and the cost of their flight, as my partner Neil tells me, is much more than anything we've ever paid for a holiday anywhere for us. So they had a crate specially designed for them so that I had males on one side and females on the other side. They were on really thick bedding. They had food and water. They travelled beautifully and arrived in Australia in really good health.
So they've come through quarantine now. Are they on farm?
Yes, they are on farm. So they arrived in Australia in January, and they had to spend, I think it was about 17 days in quarantine. So it was actually quite a quick period. They had to pass some more blood tests and so on to make sure that they were right to go. And we collected them in February, and they are on farm with us in Wamboin, New South Wales now.
Now, I know from my limited llama knowledge that there are a lot of alpacas in this country, but not as many llamas. So how important is it to get new llama genetics into Australia?
Really important, really important. We've actually only got around somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 llamas currently in Australia, whereas alpacas, and I don't know the number on that one, are far more common and in terms of farming proposition, and the numbers are much, much higher. So this new set of genetics is actually really important, not just to me for my projects and what I'd like to do with them, which is to improve the quality of my herd in a particular direction, but also for others who might also find the style of llama that I like up their alley as well.
So, yeah, that was where I was getting. A lot of this, and you described it so beautifully earlier, is a personal journey for you in terms of your relationship with this animal. But did you still have in mind the types of genetics that you're bringing into the Australian llama herd when you were going out and trying to find these animals to bring to Australia?
I did, and I had really good advice from some of the breeders over in the US as I was debating, do I get five llamas with completely different genetics to each other and different genetics to my existing herd, or do I get five llamas that have got similar phenotype and some genetic commonalities further back in their pedigrees? I went for the latter. One wonderful breeder explained it to me as being, you can take three different puzzles and put them, or five different puzzles and put them all together, and then what you actually produce is very, very unpredictable. And so I was very keen to be able to have consistency in the animals that I brought over to a certain degree in terms of their physical type and also some of their genetics way back, as well as compatibility with the llama herd that I have here in Australia. And so that's what I've tried to achieve, is something that will produce improvements on my Australian llamas with the help of these attributes from the American llamas, and consistently.
Can you describe some of the types or the genetic type that you've tried to get here?
So what I have here is what they typically call medium fleece, which is a relatively thick fleece on the llamas. I've also got a couple of Suri llamas that have got the dreadlocked fiber, which is very beautiful to watch on the move. They're just stunning. And I've got one classic llama, which is a short wool llama, which has clean legs and clean face of fleece. The ones that I'm bringing in are a combination of what they call silky fibre, which is a very soft, fine fibre, as well as Suri. And they are tall. They've got lovely long necks. They've got beautiful conformation in that their back is very straight and very strong. They're very athletic, and they're just beautiful to watch in the paddock. So in terms of garden ornaments and paddock ornaments, these guys have knocked my socks off.
Do you give them names?
Yes, and they've all been named by their breeders, apart from two. So one of them is from a breeder called Sarah McGovern at New Leaf Llamas, and she was gracefully enough to allowing me to name that one. So one of the girls is called New Leaf's Waratah, because of New South Wales national flower, or a state flower, sorry. The others are from the Siyama stud. And there's some complicated names in there. So one of them is called Rekovic. Needless to say, his paddock name is just Ray. Nebbiolo is another one, and his name is Nebby. We've got Majorca, who's May, and then we've got one called Ember.
They're the names of the llamas. Llama farmer Jane Ackland there from Wombane, near Canberra, speaking there about the llamas that were flown to Melbourne. Spent some time at the Mickleham facility just outside of Melbourne there, and now out on farm. A text here from Marius. And Marius, I reckon many sheep producers like you might hear an interview like that and think the same. Live llama export? Cruelty? ? Adds Marius. Many of you wanting to have your say about Apollo Bay and the port there, which is operated by Colac Otway Council. This one saying, g'day Woz, we can be thankful that the local Shire Council there wasn't in charge at Dunkirk, eh? Says Jungle Jim. And a bit rich of the council to deny help to farmers, says another text. And Gary, who's a bit of a lateral thinker, Gary, good afternoon to you. Love getting texts from you. Hi Woz. What's the feasibility of running a water pipeline from Cape Otway across to King Island? There's pipelines from Murray Bridge to Port Pirie and Port Augusta, Menindee to Broken Hill, or the North-South pipeline. We're talking a distance of 40 to 50 k's. this would then drought-proof an important food bowl. Oh, Gary, I don't think I'm ready for another debate around a pipeline, but it is interesting thinking all the same, and I'm glad you texted it to us. Thanks very much for that. Let's get some rural news, weather information on the way after that, although it's not probably the good news you're looking for in the weather report at the moment, but Georgie Carroll has rural news for you right now before we get to weather. Hi, Georgie.
G'day, Woz. A farmer in Tasmania has described a grisly scene finding the remains of a stud bull worth $12,000 who was shot and butchered in his paddock. Anthony Gunn, near Epping Forest outside of Launceston, suspects multiple thieves broke into a paddock adjacent to the Northern Midlands Highway and used a high-powered rifle to kill the 1,100-kilo animal. He is warning other farmers to keep an eye out for strange behaviour.
I noticed the gate was open and I thought, oh, the bulls have rubbed that open. So I went back with a bit of wire to fix the gate and I came across a bull that had been shot in the paddock beforehand, all the back straps, three legs missing off him. And then having a bit more of a look around, I could discover he'd been shot up the bank, bled there, and then he'd been dragged with a vehicle because they'd cut the gate of the lock on the road, pulled him about 50 metres into a bit of a gully away, so then perhaps you couldn't see him because it was a very moonlight night because we found him on Friday morning. I couldn't believe what I'd seen. Well, obviously, I just rang the police and got them to come out and, yeah, there's not much else you could do.
Farm crime is also on the rise in Queensland, with some farmers saying they feel violated and vulnerable as the rate of crime gets worse. In the Bundaberg region, there has been a 15-20% increase in farm crime for this year compared to last. Chief Inspector of the Bundaberg Patrol Group, Grant Marcus, says there's a pattern to bad behaviour.
They're looking for properties where they can, first of all, steal a four-wheel drive and try and locate any sort of trailer that they can use. And from there, they're using those vehicles to literally steal whatever they can. Things like power tools, looking for guns, unfortunately, but motorbikes and quad bikes and even Polaris vehicles. The reality is these days, unfortunately, farmers can't leave their sheds open. They can't leave their houses unlocked. They can't leave their keys in the ignition of their cars or anything like that or on their workbench. And that's unfortunate, but that is the world we live in.
Australian wine exports dropped in the value by 1% and by 2% by volume of wine exported out of the country in the past year. Wine Australia's latest report is claiming this as a win, saying it shows some stabilisation in exports, even as many consumers drink and spend less. Wine Australia's manager of market insights, Peter Bailey, says some markets are growing for various reasons.
Hong Kong, for example, had some very strong growth, and also in New Zealand we saw an increase, but also in our number one market, the UK, we saw an increase in value. There has been that increase in consumers opting to drink at home rather than bars and restaurants, and that's really to save money during the cost of living crisis, where we've seen, you know, very high inflation in the UK over the last 12 to 18 months. And Australia has a very strong share of the off-premise sales in the UK, and we are the number one category in that segment of the market. So that really does benefit our exports as they move away from the on-premise.
Australian researchers are looking to capitalise on a rising demand for oat-based products across the world. A nationwide collaboration between the Grains Research Development Corporation, scientists and industry will work on ways to boost Australia's oat production, including improving taste, shelf life and potential new products. It's being led by Intergrain and the South Australian Research and Development Institute. SARDI's crop and pasture improvement manager, Dr. Janine Crozer, hopes the $12.5 million program will open up Australian oats to new global markets.
It addresses right from the laboratory level, where we're looking at the genetics through breeding and then to our producers and processors, the products that are on the shelf in the supermarket. I think you could describe oats as a little bit of an orphan in terms of research if you compare them to their big cousins of wheat and barley. It has been a fairly small crop in Australia across the years. It's obviously now growing in popularity. So it opened the door to really starting to invest in oats, to look at ways that we can capture markets that are going to lead to a higher value farm gate for our producers.
A Riverland winery has planted more than 4,000 square metres of native bushland across Victoria and South Australia, thanks to a partnership with a not-for-profit organisation. Winery Oxford Landing is working with environmental group Greenfleet to plant more native bushland to match wines sold in a bid to offset carbon emissions. Louisa Rose is the head of sustainability for the Hillsmith family estate and says it's a big effort but worth it.
For every six bottles of wine that we sell, we're organising with Greenfleet to plant one square metre of bushland. They're wanting to plant to increase, you know, carbon sequestration, of course, and biodiversity and native vegetation and all that sort of stuff. And we too like to have a lot of biodiversity and native vegetation within and around our vineyards because we think it's the right thing to do.
And that's what's making rural news.
Much appreciated. Thank you very much for that, Georgie. Carol there with rural news for you on the Country Hour this lunchtime, just on the issue of trying to get hay to King Island to feed drought-stricken cattle. This text says, where's the old Australia? In brackets, help a mate. We loved. A lot of exclamation marks after that as well. Thank you for sending that through. You can keep those texts coming, 0467 842 722. To send a text, 0467 842 722. More of your text shortly. Let's go to Joanna Hughes, though, to find out what's happening, or probably more importantly, what's not happening in the weather right now from the Bureau of Meteorology. G'day, Jo.
G'day, Waza. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good. How's it looking around Victoria?
It's looking pretty quiet. We've got just a couple of showers lingering around southern parts today, but just sort of drizzly light stuff, getting a bit of a wrap of the rain totals from the front that crossed over yesterday. We sort of, after 9 a.m, it was sort of crossing over eastern parts of the state. So the highest rainfall that we saw in the gauge was about 12 millimetres at Mount Baw-Baw. Otherwise, 1 to 3 millimetres across sort of southeastern parts of Victoria, but remaining dry elsewhere.
Somewhere broke 10 mil, though. So Mount Baw-Baw, shout out to you, right? Like.
Yeah, that's a pretty good effort with a fairly modest front, shall we say, as it made its way across. For the rest of today, we've just got that cloud south of the ranges and, as I say, a couple of isolated drizzly showers here and there, but nothing to write home about. In terms of our temperatures for the day, we're heading for maximums getting close to 20 degrees up in northern parts of the state, sort of sitting more around your sort of mid-teens through the ranges and, mid-teens in southern parts of the state as well today. Tomorrow, those temperatures creeping up a little bit higher and the sunshine should come out a little bit more in southern parts of the state, much like it is up in the north at the moment, beautiful and clear on the satellite as we speak. And then it's pretty much a bit of a rinse and repeat pattern for the rest of the week. Those temperatures sort of staying fairly cool to mild right throughout the week. We've got a high-pressure system that's making a comfortable home for itself in the Great Australian Bight and just hanging out there in that sort of blocking pattern for the next little while. So that's leading to partly cloudy conditions with just a couple of isolated showers about the coasts over the coming days, and then fairly cool conditions inland in the morning. So we can expect some frosty conditions up in northeastern parts of the state, particularly over the coming days, and a few bits of fog here and there in the south, but nothing particularly impactful on the cars. The only thing that I mentioned for today that I forgot to mention at the top of the description there is that we do have a sort of low-level jet, so where there's sort of some winds a bit closer to the surface than usual, some of those upper winds. So it may get a little bit breezy sort of on and north of the ranges today in the southerly winds this afternoon, but that should be clearing out and then, as I say, just settled really for the rest of the week, and really nothing much else to report there, was there? It's just Settled as.
I like that. We'll use that in the future. So nothing really warnings wise, I suppose, we need to write home about.
No, nothing too much to report. We did have a sheep graziers warning was out this morning for some of those cool temperatures and a couple of those isolated showers around and some of those winds picking up a little bit. But otherwise nothing to report in terms of warnings for Victoria, which is good news.
So we'll just repeat this conversation over the coming days. Thanks, Jo.
Yeah. You'll have some other people to bring their take over the next few days. But pretty quiet.
Brilliant. Joanna Hughes there, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, taking you through the full forecast there. Look, they've always got plenty to talk about, even if there's not much happening, and that's good too. You can keep your texts coming. We'll get to those. You might want to comment on this. I'd love you to tell me what you think Australia's biggest dairy farm is right now, because what was formerly Australia's biggest dairy farm has put up the for sale sign. A former chief executive of Van Diemen's Land Company has actually called out the Foreign Investment Review Board for failing to audit the conditions the international company that took over Woolnorth Dairy was supposed to adhere to. Woolnorth was Australia's biggest dairy farm in the top northwestern tip of Tasmania. It was bought by Moonlake Investments and called Van Dairy amid big plans to sell fresh milk to China. The company, however, was plagued by problems, including animal welfare and environmental issues. And now the balance of the property has been put up for sale after already a milk contract has been lost with the massive company Fonterra and hundreds of cattle have been culled. Former CEO Evan Rowley says he's pleased it's now up for sale because there were a lot of problems.
As part of the conditions under which the sale was approved by the then Treasurer Morrison, five conditions were placed on Mr. Liu in relation to that purchase. And there was no auditing, independent auditing of those, none of the drought-proofing projects, the important projects around employment, additional employment in the Northwest Coast, the value-added processing. I mean, it just was disappointing to note that, yeah, the federal government let the ball down as well in terms of managing the FIRB approval conditions.
So you obviously thought during your involvement that it could happen, you could see fresh milk going to China, that it would be good for Tasmania, employment, investment.
Yeah, indeed. And, I mean, in fact, that was the whole reason that both David Crean took on the chairmanship and I've been working previously for the New Zealanders on developing those drought-proofing plans. And we saw this as a great opportunity to rebuild and build on from what the New Zealanders as owners had delivered to Woolnorth. And there was all these commitments made, the board appointed with a lot of expertise from both New Zealand and from the northwest coast of Tasmania, an excellent team of 25 dairy managers. It was all set for that level of investment, but unfortunately none of that transpired, and it was not audited independently by FIRB to ensure that these conditions for foreign investment were being met. So in the end, both Dr. Crean and certainly I felt that there was no way the program would be delivered and sustainability of the Woolnorth farms was at risk. So, we both, the board resigned and I moved on back to the farm in the Huon.
So you're putting the blame squarely on the Foreign Investment Review Board there, not following up on promises?
Well, when these are conditions of foreign investment in Australia, when we need investment in Australia to improve productivity and to expand opportunities in the international market, we need those investments to be made, but we need a federal government to police these and independently assess that the environmental and financial and other conditions that are part of that FIRB approval are being met. And if not, there should be significant penalties applied to foreign investors who don't meet the conditions that they have voluntarily signed up for as part of their investment.
Did your board have any dealings with the federal government or the Foreign Investment Review Board at the time?
Well, the board was made aware, obviously, of the full extent of the commitments, and part of what was being done by the board was monitoring those commitments, particularly in relation to initiatives to drought-proof and improve environmental outcomes on the farms, to look at the opportunities for value-added processing. You might recall at the time the Edith Creek processing plant had come to the end of that investment cycle. So there was a logical opportunity for the investor to, invest there to develop the milk export business that he was committed to doing. The federal and state governments also provided support for this work, but clearly, you need an independent audit of these FIRB conditions to ensure that Australians, wherever these investments occur, are realising the commitments that have been made by the investors. And in this case, self-reporting by the owners of the capital that's been made is not the way to ensure that the commitments will be honoured.
So lessons learnt by this overseas purchase?
Make sure that strict conditions in foreign investment decisions are made and then independently audited, not by self-reporting by the owners of the capital investment, but by, you know, well-experienced and independent parties who can ensure that Australians do benefit from the flow of overseas capital into, you know, major projects. And my great hope is that Woolnorth, which is a superb environment, is returned to its, you know, sustainability, and that the environmental and animal welfare matters that are so important for society are absolutely met.
It's former CEO of Van Dairy, which was the place where Woolnorth Farm is now, Evan Rowley is his name. He was talking to Fiona Bream about Woolnorth Dairy going onto the market, up for sale now, no longer Australia's largest dairy. I wonder what is. If you have an answer to that question, send us a text, 0467 842 722. Let's talk cropping right now, though, because while the dry weather isn't great for getting crops growing, it is allowing grain growers to make good progress on their sowing programs. John Ferrier, who farms 25 kilometres north of Birchip, has completed about 40% of his. Angus Verley spoke to him about what's behind him and what lays ahead.
We have done all our vetch and all our barley, some of our canola, so we've done long season variety canola. We still have some short season varieties to go. And at the moment, we are sowing lentils. So, yes, quite timely. But the conditions are, you might say, dry enough, although we have subsoil moisture.
So just on the conditions, what you've sown, is it? Would you call it proper dry sowing, or are you sowing into sort of patchy moisture?
I think we're going into, it's drier now, but earlier on it was quite mixed moisture, and some of the canola has germinated, so I'm thinking that we're going to see a mixed germination in our earlier variety canola. You know, you always like a shower of rain after sowing canola because it's such a small seed, but we are seeing some of our barley emerging, so the points on the sowing machine have got some dampness on them, and up until, you know, the later part of last week, the press wheels were still picking up a bit of moisture. So I'm pretty sure we'll see some of the barley emerging too.
Okay, so you'll have some parts of some paddocks emerge, but the drier parts of those paddocks, that the seed will just be sitting there?
Yes, we're quite confident they're sitting there. It's really, quite nice and timely for the sowing program. So, you know, we'll be looking at, we'll be heading to 35, 40% of our total program sown. And so we've already got lentils and this little bit of a paddock of late season canola to go. So, yeah, we're sort of hopeful that we'll see a decent break, but it is very settled autumn weather at the moment, Angus.
And John, I know it's tricky to answer these questions, but with the crop that has germinated, is that going to have enough moisture around the seed to get it down into your subsoil moisture, or will you need another rain to get those roots down?
In the Mallee, we always need another rain, but I'm confident that what has germinated is in good moisture. So, you know, the summer spraying program was quite good, and we know we've got stored moisture there by our soils profile and that we've done in the soil testing and the probes we have in. So I'm sure that it'll hang on for quite some time, Angus.
And it seems that the start date of sowing, or the targeted finish date perhaps, seems to push forward a little bit each year. Is that just people seeing a track record that it's typically the earlier sown crops outperforming the late sown crops?
Yeah, the evidence is showing that, but that is the case. But also, you've also got to be aware that you're probably putting yourself more at risk of frost. So really, the varieties that you choose are important. Like I was sort of saying, we'd sown our long season canola variety. So having a spread flowering date in the spring to minimise the frost risk, those also important. So, yeah, over the years, that earlier sowing has proved to be, you know, a lot far in advance of late sowing. But speaking to some older farmers, there's been plenty of late breaks that have also produced some very good crops. So it's all a bit unknown, as once again.
And people's approach at the moment with no rain on the forecast to speak of, John, are people just going along at a pretty steady pace rather than madly trying to get the crop in before a rain?
Yeah, that's the case. I think quite often, you know, every day you'll see seeders going and some dust coming up. I think there might have been a quieter pace over the weekend. But, in our case, we're doing decent days, but not overdoing it, because I think in looking at the short-term forecast, it doesn't seem to be too much today predicted in the next fortnight. So we know that we've got that space. And if we see a rain coming, we'll certainly ramp it up and get the crop in ahead of the rain, which will be beneficial to us.
That is John Ferrier speaking to Angus Verley there. He farms north of Birchip, talking all things sowing and where he is up to. Let's finish today's Country Hour in Corryong in northeast Victoria, which went through a lot. Many challenges, including fires, floods and other issues, saw this community rally together through initiatives like the Acres and Acres Food Cooperative, which provides fresh produce and meals to locals doing it tough. Faith Tabaluyan caught up with farm leader Lalita Linklater to check out their winter crops and how the co-op's going.
After the 2020 bushfires, a couple of the community members came together and they were talking about how can we, you know, provide more food, local food for the community. And there's a lot of growers in this town, in this region. The idea was to link all of these people together, hence the name Acres and Acres. It's like so many people growing, let's link it all together. And initially it was more of like a food share, food swap kind of idea. And then from that it grew to, okay, let's actually produce large amounts. Let's make really healthy, cheap boxes. So they started selling $35 boxes and delivering them out. And then from there, it moved into the shop where we're providing, you know, more than your standard grocery store. Like, we obviously, there's a lot of local, as fresh as possible and cheaper.
And so since you've opened up the shop, you've now grown to having about 250 members of the local community who are really supporting you in this. What's that been like to have that support?
Oh, it's amazing. You know, we've got just all the friendly, awesome faces who come in and they love what we're doing. They love the idea. And, you know, I'm not from this town originally. I've come here about 5 years ago, and I'm just amazed by how connected the community is, how just everyone wants to help. And yeah, 250, I mean, that sounds amazing because it's a small population here, but that just shows how many people want to support it.
I did want to ask you as well, Lalita, about your role as a farm leader. So what does that actually involve? You know, we're standing here looking out over your garden, essentially. But yeah, so what does your role involve?
So my role involves planting crops, you know, starting all the seedlings, having a supply of what we need in shop available down here. I've sort of just taken over the role, so it's been a lot of reclaiming the land and having it ready for the next season of growing, which is now well underway, and I'm excited.
And you just planted your winter crop, so what have we got in there now?
So we're looking over a row of peas, two different varieties. We've got two rows of cauliflower, and they have a companion herb with them, which is dill. We've got two rows of broccoli, we've got a row of spring onions, and then two rows of kale, a row of spinach, beetroot, pak choi. We've got beans in the ground, we won't see them till they pop up, and can't remember, silver beet, that's right. I have had help with the bigger tools, you know, the excavator and the tractor. I'm not going to drive those, even though my boss wants me to, maybe one day. But most of it has been a lot of hand tools, hard labour, and good accidental exercise, keeping me fit.
You don't actually have an ag background per se. You came from a circus background. So that's how did you stumble into this?
Well, my parents, they live up in northern New South Wales in the subtropics, but they've always been about organic farming. My dad, he's done organic farming courses. So I've been around it since, you know, I was born. And I guess that's where my knowledge of plants has come about. Been a home gardener since I can remember. And obviously I've got a long way to come. I've got training to do with all the farming tools. And I actually set up the watering system we're looking at, which I never thought I would be able to do. But hey, it's really simple. So some of it is actually really easy. Some of it I will need guidance. But as you can see, things are coming along quite nicely.
That's Acres and Acres Co-op farm leader Lalita Linklater speaking there with Faith Tabaluyan from the town of Corryong. She had some beautiful noises in the back. I love the northeast of Victoria. I'd love to get back up there again sometime soon. But right now, we're getting back into it with market information for you. Let's head to markets. And we'll start today with the sheep and lamb market reports, which means heading along to Ballarat on a Tuesday. And Jenny Kelly, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good lambs held their form at Ballarat today in a bigger yarding of 28,200 head. Some big crossbreds up around 38 kilos carcass weight, topping at $270 to be a few dollars above last Tuesday's high price. But the middle rut of trade lambs eased off last week's more intense market. Overall, the majority of trade and heavy lambs to processors were averaging between 6.50 to 6.90 cents a kilo, with select pens of really neat lambs with shape selling above 700 cents to supermarket and exporters at times. Big export lambs over 30 kilos carcass weight, 190 to 270 to average $237. The heavy 26 to 30 kilos, 170 to 206. Heavy trades, 156 to 180. And the 22 to 24 kilos, 140 to 171 to average $155 a head. Light lambs had some dearer results throughout the auction, but ended up similar overall to a week ago at $80 to $135 for most. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thank you very much for that, Jenny. Let's go to the cattle now. Leanne Dax has Wodonga information for you.
Good afternoon. Cattle numbers jumped up to 1,800 at Wodonga. However, quality remained mixed. The standout performers were heavy cattle. These cattle gained 20 to 40 cents. Heavy steers and bullocks sold in a range of 270 to 328. Heavy heifers jumped 20 to 30 cents, selling from 274 to 312. Cow buyers showed increased interest, and companies were specifically looking for good big cows with plenty of yield. Heavy cows sold at 244 to 265, jumping 27 cents. Leaner types benefited from strong restocking demand, 140 to 228. In the trade market, veal sold from 320 to 402. The better calves held firm. Trade steers remained firm to 10 cheaper, ranging from $3 to 350. Trade heifers bounced 20, 285 to 310. Feeder steers experienced a decline of 20 cents, which was quality related, while the heifer portion gained 10. Overall, feeder heifers were priced at 230 to 310. Leanne Dax, MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Leanne. Lucky last is Nicole Varley, who has the Shepherd and Cattle Market Report. Hi, Nicole.
Afternoon, Warwick. Well, we had 1,660 head numbers and strengthened off the back of the short week. Quality improved in the export section, with growing steers and bullocks having more shape and finish. Competition was stronger for the better finish lines of heavy cattle. We also saw that 15 to 30 cent jump across most lines of the growing steers and cows. The young cattle, though, they were fairly plain in quality, with most going back out to the feedlot or store operators, so fairly mixed results there. The vealers range from 280 to a top of 370 cents, yearling steers 260 to 315, the yearling heifer portion 250 to 320, the 500-600 kilo steers 305 to 335 cents, while the 600 kilo plus bullocks, they reached a top of 340. The heavy beef cows 210 to 275 cents, they saw healthy gains, and the heavy dairy cows 179 to 217. This is Nicole Varley from Shepparton.
Thanks very much for that, Nicole. That's about all the time we have for you on the Country Hour today. A couple of your votes for what is the biggest dairy farm now. Moxie's, maybe. says Anthony, I think, on the text. Brad says, I'm not sure of the size, but the Circular Heads farming operations is quite large in Smithton in northwest Tasmania as well, adding that there's a setup there to give young farmers the opportunity to buy into the business. It's a positive for the dairy industry. Thanks for that information. Sounds like they're things we should be talking about more in the future. That's it for the Country Hour today, though. Remember, you can listen back to the Country Hour wherever you get your podcasts or in the ABC Listen app. I'll talk to you in May. Catch ya.